Today is Friday, March 4th, 2022. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Gary Ladd. Gary's last name is spelled L-A-D-D. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Gary. How are you?
I'm good.
Great. We are, thank you so much for hosting us today at your kitchen table here in Page, Arizona. Appreciate that. Gary, at the end of part one, you were in college and had been working at the radio station and, doing the typical college things. And you mentioned last time you met a fellow named Jim Huckins, H-U-C-K-I-N-S, and he introduced you to the world of caving. Can you open that up and pick that story up there?
Yes, I was in a geology course, and Jim Huckins was a lab instructor, and he gave a program on caves, and I immediately talked to him about it afterwards, and he invited me on a trip. So that was the beginning of a period of time for me that was, I thought, just incredibly interesting. And we ended up frequently going to caves in Missouri. Missouri has more caves than any other state. Missouri has wet caves, so they were often very muddy. There were clubs in Columbia, Missouri, University of Missouri, called Grotto, that had students primarily, but also older people, that met to do caving trips. And Jim and I and some of his friends that he had before I met him started doing all sorts of trips in Missouri, and also made a trip into Tennessee to Cumberland Caverns, which was a commercial cave, but it was run by or owned by somebody who was deeply involved in wild caving. And maybe much more important than that, Jim had a connection with someone who had a key to a cave in northwestern Arkansas. The name of that cave was either Beauty Cave or Fitton Cave, F-I-T-T-O-N. And we made, I think, several trips down there. And it was incredible. It was a wild cave. It had a couple of entrances. It had all sorts of features, all sorts of different types of speleothems, different kinds of formations. And partly because of caves and the difficulty, and also in some cases the ease of photographing them, it really spurred me on my photography. Because unlike taking pictures in the outdoors at Grand Canyon, you're not relying on the sun. You are designing your own illumination. So you carry different kinds of flash equipment, and you can, without moving the camera, you can take pictures, different kinds of pictures from the same location, just depending upon the illumination, what part of the scene that you choose to focus on, and what part do you just allow to go black. So it's really interesting. We also started making trips, two trips down into Mexico to do some pits. And
wow.
There were vertical caves in Missouri, but I don't think any of them were more than a 100-foot drop at a time. But Mexico had some karst topography and tremendous deep pits. We never did visit Golondrinas, but it had a drop of 1,100 feet free fall. So when you got to the bottom of it, of course, I was never there. I'm just describing photographs that I saw. You could see the rope leaving your position, but it went up into the bright sky and just disappeared.
So, wow. And you'd have to ascend. I mean, people who were in that
Yes.
You have to ascend with a mechanical ascender, but you have to push the thing up and then step up and push up and step up for 1,000 feet.
That's right. On a rope. Yeah.
Wow. Gary, I had a question for you though about the caves in Tennessee and Arkansas. Is this the Red Wall limestone unit that we see here in the Southwest? Is it the same limestone unit out there?
I am not sure about that.
Okay.
I think the age of the limestones is about the same.
Okay.
But I'm not even positive about that.
Okay.
That's my impression.
Okay. But it is, these are limestone caves?
Yes.
Back east. But they're wet. They're not dry like our caves here mostly are. So lots of mud?
Lots of mud, yep.
And you would have gotten introduced to climbing ropes and rappelling and ascending?
Yeah, that's true. And I skipped over that because we practiced a lot of times, of course, before we would even go into a cave. So not too far from Fayette, where the college was located, we could drive... it was like half an hour away and kind of near Boonville, Missouri, to some bluffs along the Missouri River. And it was pretty easy to climb to the top of a bluff and then rappel, and that drop was about 100 feet. But unfortunately, it came right down on some railroad tracks. So we had to be a little careful about that. But we'd go out there and just... practice and play around a lot.
And would you ascend, then use the ascenders to go back up?
I don't think we ever went up that cliff.
Okay.
And I'm not sure why that is. But
so was your ascending experience on the job in a cave? This is how it works, get going, or?
Well, I can remember one time when we went to an even bigger bluff near Herman, Missouri, and threw the rope over, but we weren't sure that it reached the bottom. We couldn't see. So we did have ascenders on that, and in that case, it did not reach the bottom. So
So then you had to regroup, and instead of going down, you had to set up the ascenders and get that all hooked up safely so that you could start going back up the rope?
Well, you know, I'm not sure who did this. It might have been me, but one of us went first and got partway down and realized the rope did not reach the bottom. So we had ascenders with us, and we rappelled into support by the ascenders, and then detached the rappel gear and then ascended. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So I do remember that one case of where we got some practice ascending, not in a cave.
On the job practice, hanging off a cliff.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. So then. It's interesting to think about setting up a camera. Did you use a tripod in the cave?
Yes, we...
Wow. So you had a lot of gear you were bringing along.
Yes, yep. And, you know, to me, kind of interestingly, this is my introduction to ammo cans. That is how we carried our gear into caves.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's mud and water. It's kind of like a river trip.
Okay.
So we had ammo cans, and we had usually small tripods that would collapse down to just 6 inches tall or so.
Oh, wow. So really small.
Yes.
Okay. And an ammo can is maybe a foot by 8 inches by 10 inches, and that's sort of that size with a little handle on top.
Yeah.
Metal can with a rubber seal where the top of the can would seal down.
I think we called them 50 caliber ammo cans. Okay. Yeah. And then we had smaller ones, and usually each person just had one of these cans, and most of our gear was in that can, most of the gear.
Okay. So it was pretty packed.
Yeah. You know, in a cave, depending upon what kind of cave it is and what kind of contortions you have to do to get through it, you've got to have things pretty small. And
okay.
We would stay in caves for as long as 24 hours.
Wow.
So we didn't have sleeping bags or anything like that, but we had to have the food and the photo gear and, if necessary, some climbing gear.
Okay. Help me understand a little bit. I put the camera on a tripod and it's dark. You
Right.
have a lantern.
We were using carbide lamps at the time.
Carbide lanterns. Okay, can you describe that lantern, how that worked?
We could buy cans of carbide, and the lanterns were just a flame with a reflector behind it, and it had a chamber that contained some of these nuggets of carbide, and then an upper chamber that had water in it, and a control that would allow water to drip on the carbide. And acetylene was produced in this reaction, and it came out a tip in the center of a reflector. And it was certainly not bright, but when you get dark adapted, it was quite adequate, quite amazing. You just had to be careful if you were crawling behind someone else to not get too close to them.
To burn them with your lantern,
Right.
with the torch on your light.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of a joke. I don't remember anyone ever being really burned by one, but it was before batteries were common.
Okay.
So
So that was your lighting for your personal equipment. What kind of lighting did you use for your photographs?
Well, at that time, I'm not sure I remember this, but M3B flash bulbs, I might have that right or partially right. They were the brightest source we had, I think. But electronic flash units were coming out at that time, but they were not as bright. They were just very convenient. So
Okay.
we had both with us. And the technique was set the camera up on a tripod, and of course, it's not as important as in the outdoors for the viewer to have a position where the camera is located that's up at somewhere near eye level. You can be lower or higher, but you're never going to know as the viewer of the photograph how high above the ground you are.
Okay.
And usually this is a more than one person operation. There will be two or three people taking the picture, somebody operating the camera, and at times blocking light from coming to the lens. Because you would open up the shutter after you had positioned people out in the scene that you wanted to illuminate. But they needed to be able to move around somewhat and have light to do it, and you didn't necessarily want to have their movements recorded on the film. So someone who was back at the camera, usually the camera owner, would block the light and be giving instructions to people out in front. So I'd open the shutter after people were in position. They would fire off flashes. And when those flashes went off, I would block the camera again. And then those people would move to a new
Oh,
location.
wow.
Depending upon how big the room is, you might have to have many different flashes to illuminate things from
Wow.
different positions. So it was a very time-consuming, very interesting way of taking pictures. And I just love taking pictures in caves.
Were people like Jim Huckins and the other cavers you were with, were they willing to take the time to help you with these photographs?
Almost all of us were all very deeply involved in photography.
Oh, nice.
Jim Huckins was his friend that I didn't meet until later, although his name comes up much more often later. Bill Schoening was a cave explorer. He was deeply involved in taking pictures and in photography. His last name is spelled Schoening.
Thank you.
He lived in St. Louis and had already graduated by the time that I met Jim. Jim Palmer was another guy who was often part of our group. But there were four or five or six of us. Roy Gold was another one. He lived, I think, in Boonville, not too far away. But all of us were involved in photography. I haven't really thought about that. I don't know, a little strange maybe,
Well,
but.
no, it makes perfect sense because otherwise, people that aren't interested in photography, they're going to take off. They're
Yes.
going to keep exploring the cave, and you'll be set by yourself, and you can't sit out the lights and work it out like you could if you had extra people that wanted to see that picture you were going to make
Right.
and were invested in it.
But those were great times, great trips. We just had a heck of a time. I don't think anyone ever got hurt on any of those trips, and there weren't a huge number. I would think all of my caving trips put together probably only came to 20 or 30, something like that.
That's a
But,
lot.
well, we did the best we could, I guess. But Jim was a little older than me. He graduated a year or two before I did. And then I did a little bit of caving afterwards, but it wasn't too long before I moved to Arizona and was unable to break into caving here. Here, my impression was, and I think I'm correct about this, caving was taken much more seriously, and there were secret places, and you just weren't allowed to join these groups or these people unless they were sure that you weren't going to go in there and start breaking off some of the formations. And at the same time, I think I only did one caving trip in Arizona to Pepper Sauce Cave near Tucson, but it was being replaced by canyons. So I was willing to give up caves.
When you were at the peak of your caving, taking these photographs, did you get your photographs out in any magazines or any publications?
No, and I don't think I was trying to. Looking back on it, I'm not sure what I was thinking, but I just don't think that was part of what any of us were that interested in. Although at about that time, National Geographic had a really nice article on caves, and there was a name that still stands out in my mind, Earl Neller, who did a lot of photography, and I think Jim Huckins may have known him. Neller is how you spell his last name. I don't think I ever met him, although years later, decades later, when I was helping to run elder hostel classes here in Page, I did have a student on one of those classes who was a name I recognized from that National Geographic article.
Oh, wow.
And that may have been Earl, but I don't think that quite fits. I don't think I remember that name, but anyway, we were aware that you could get cave pictures published, but there weren't too many outlets for that.
And so what you guys were doing then was setting a point in time. This is what this cave looks like now. And so today, that record would be very important, I think.
Yes, but caves are usually very stable and they don't change very fast.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So how did you go from caving? How did you get out west then?
Okay. Well, during the time that I was in school and Jim Huckins was there, a friend of his, Bill Sheening, that I mentioned earlier, came for a visit, and he was a teacher in another college town in Missouri. But he had an interest in photography, a very strong interest. He had a lot of equipment, including Bolex movie cameras, And when I first met him, for some reason, this meeting took place at the radio station, and Bill had an ammo can with him, and he popped it open, and there inside that can was a name that still sticks with me today, Nikon. Because I was aware of Nikon cameras. I did not have a Nikon at the time. And I think it was a brand new camera, and I think both Jim and I went, ooh. As if we were looking into some magic box or something. But anyway, I don't think I did any trips with Bill Shaning. And I was about to move with my parents from, actually, I don't remember how this goes exactly, trying to match up when we move from place to place. But at a later date, we were moving back to Missouri, back to the St. Louis area, from the Cleveland, Ohio area, the second time we had done that. And when I got back in St. Louis in the summer, it was just before my senior year, and I called Bill. And at that time, he was in St. Louis for some reason. And we decided to get together, and there was a new movie out called 2001, A Space Odyssey, that we decided to see. And we spent some time together that summer, and shortly after that, he had told me that he had gotten a job at Kitt Peak National Observatory. And he had a connection with astronomy because both he and his father were also carpenters or metal workers. And Bill had done a lot of work on a 12-inch refracting telescope that was on the campus of Central Methodist College, a really old, kind of famous telescope. And it needed a lot of work, and Bill had greatly improved on it.
Wow.
There was a meeting of astronomers there at that observatory, and he met one of the directors of Kitt Peak National Observatory, who was impressed with Bill and asked him to come out for the summer just to see if he'd like to work there, which Bill did, and the observatory staff was very happy with him. And because of Bill's photography background, he ended up taking care of the astronomical photography department.
Oh, wow.
At Kitt Peak. And I stayed in contact with Bill, and when he got his permanent job, I rode along with him from St. Louis to Tucson just to give him some company in the long drive.
And what year was this? Do you remember?
This would have been 68.
Okay.
Because I was still in school.
Right, you had one more year to go.
Right.
And in 1968, Kitt Peak, can you describe its location and where it is in relationship to Tucson, Arizona?
Kitt Peak is southwest of Tucson.
Okay.
Probably 40 miles away in a straight line.
Okay.
And the elevation on the summit is just a little bit below 7,000 feet.
Okay.
It's pretty far away from big cities, Tucson being the biggest problem there, and was on what was then the Papago Indian Reservation, and had become the National Observatory in the 1950s because it was felt that the country needed a place where astronomers from all over the country could go and use the best equipment under very dark skies, even if their institutions where they worked did not have that equipment.
Oh, wow.
So it became the world's largest concentration of optical telescopes. And about the time that I got there, I think it was kind of at its peak with 150-inch telescope under construction when I arrived in 1972. But I'm jumping ahead here.
Yeah, so let's just put a comma there. We'll come back to that. 150 inches?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Let me just stop for a minute. That's a
12,
13 feet diameter? Yeah. Wow. Really big. So you came out in the summer of 68?
With Bill on his trip. Yeah. Right.
Just to come out with him, get him out there, look things around. What did you see? What did you see when you did that?
Yeah, well, I had never been in southern Arizona before. I had been to the Grand Canyon, but not southern Arizona. And it was incredibly pretty. And I was impressed with the desert. I was impressed with the very wide, straight streets. I was impressed with the weather. And then Bill took me up to see the mountain, and I was flabbergasted at how terrific that place was, just because of the scientific work that was being there, and it was also extraordinarily pretty.
Hmm.
So I decided that's where I wanted to work. So when I graduated, I had a divisional science degree, and I applied for a job. And there was a particular opening that I was trying to get, called a night assistant. That terminology is often used in astronomy, and it can mean many different things. In this case, it was someone who was assisting an astronomer with his work. Eventually, I did become a night assistant, but in that case, it meant somebody who was part of a team of night assistants who would help with instrument changes during the day or anything that needed to be done in preparation for the nights, and then would stay up. We would take turns staying up late at night and sit in an office and wait for calls from astronomers who were having a problem.
Oh, wow.
So those problems could be that a reticle light went out and they could no longer use the finder properly. It could be that the floor, which rises and falls as the telescope moves, stopped working. It could be that the dome was acting strangely. You couldn't rotate it to the proper direction.
Hmm.
Could mean that the wind was coming up and you couldn't close the shutter. It could mean the toilet was overflowing. Anything that came up during the night when the rest of the staff wasn't there.
Okay.
So
how did you hear about that job in the first place? Did you hear about that in 1968? Was Bill saying, okay, Gary, if you're interested in this, this is how you want to kind of go about it, looking for a job?
Yeah, I kind of doubt if I was thinking about getting a job there immediately when I first visited. I don't know when that really got serious, but probably... I'll add on a little side thing here. When I got out of college, I didn't know what I was going to do, and the first job that I got was working in a photography store.
Okay.
And that didn't pay very well. It was minimum wage, $1.65 an hour.
$1.65?
$1.65.
Wow. And this was in 1969.
That's right, yeah. So it was, I think, terrific for me at that time. I got to learn a lot about cameras because we were allowed to borrow cameras on the weekends so that we know what we were talking about.
Wow.
People came in and asked about different cameras. So you could even take home a Hasselblad if you wanted to.
Or one of those nice Nikons.
Or one of those Nikons, yes.
Wow.
But I actually did have a Nikon by the time I got out of college, so...
Okay.
Yeah. My parents took care of that. And
nice.
So I only worked there for a few months because there was more action in Arizona that I was interested in. because Bill Schoening, because of his connections to the Sierra Club, when he moved to Arizona, met Francois Lede, and they became friends. Francois, of course, mentioned this isn't the best time to ask me how to spell Francois.
Yeah, F-R-A-N.
C-O-I-S, maybe.
Yeah.
L-E-D-E-T, maybe.
Yeah.
So, Francois was the author of the book, Time and the River Flowing, and he told Bill that he had an upcoming dory trip. He may have shown Bill photographs from his previous trip with Martin Litton. And Bill said, boy, I'd be interested in going, and he got invited. So that was in the summer of 1969.
Okay.
It was the 100th anniversary of the Powell expedition that Bill participated in. So I learned about, I already had an interest in Grand Canyon, but it was highly undeveloped. But Bill told me about that trip and probably showed me pictures pretty soon. And I knew I wanted to go. So I did join Bill and another fellow from Kitt Peak, Tom Zenter. There were three of us on that trip, all of us from Kitt Peak. Tom's last name is Zinter. And we went on Martin's first of his two trips that year. Plus, there was another guy from Kitt Peak who was interested in going, Jim Deveny, D-E-V-E-N-Y. And he went on Martin's second trip. Well, we were all blown away maybe I shouldn't try to speak for the others, but I was blown away by the adventure of going down the rapids and rowing those little wooden boats and the beauty in the side canyons and the camps and just everything about it. I was really hooked immediately. So that was in the summer of 71 for me. And
okay, so I just kind of following the timeline, you graduated in 69. You had come out the year before with Bill in 68.
Right.
And then you got the job at the photography store in the summer of 69.
Right.
And this river trip with Martin, was that in 69 as well? That was 71.
71.
Okay.
Yeah.
So between 69 and 71, what was going on in there?
Okay. Well, from I think it was the fall of 69 until the spring or maybe summer of 1970, I was working at that camera store.
Okay.
Yeah, there's something that doesn't make sense to me in the timing here, but I'm going to continue on as if there's not a problem.
Okay. And I'm going to ask you about that. So during this time, were you continuing to send Kitt Peak applications for this night assistant job?
I don't really remember when I sent my first application in, but it may have been as late as the summer of 71.
Okay.
After I worked at the camera store, because that paid so poorly, and I had a friend who had gone to work for Goodyear Tire and Rubber, working in a warehouse, that paid two or three times as much. So I did that off and on for the next year or year and a half, I think. They couldn't always use me, so some seasons there wasn't that much activity in that warehouse. But it was unloading boxcars of tires.
Oh, wow.
So, and
Were they on pallets, or were they just free tires that had been stacked up in a boxcar, and you started at the top and rolled them out?
They were just laced in together from floor to ceiling. You climbed up walls of tires and threw them down, and then put them on pallets to be taken into the warehouse.
The forklift then would take them in. And were they all like the same size, or did you have to sort them out by size?
Many different sizes in every boxcar.
Wow.
And usually there would be one guy with a forklift helping me unload. He would keep moving more pallets into place, and I'd load them up, and then he'd take the full pallets and store them somewhere in the building.
Would you size them out at the time? The different, so give me 60, or give me 6 different pallets, and I'll put this size there and that size there. And wow.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't that complicated. It was just climbing up and down. And
good exercise.
Good exercise.
And the smell of rubber must have been kind of overpowering.
Boy, anytime I get near a new tire today, it immediately takes me back 50 years and working in that warehouse.
Wow.
Yeah. I smelled like tires when I went home every night.
Wow. Yeah.
And I don't know if it's the glycerin that they use on tires, but that there's some particular tire smell that I strongly associate with 1970, 71.
During that time, what was your favorite camera?
I had Nikkormats at that time, and I used Nikkormats for a long time. So Nikkormat. And they were just a reduced version of a Nikon. Made by Nikon.
Oh.
But not the fancy, really expensive edge of technology, but down a step, but high quality, very dependable, used all Nikon optics, and I never felt a need to have a Nikon F, which were popular at that time. Not until recently. I can see that I can now buy a Nikon F on the used market for $50. No longer in working order, but I'm tempted to get one of those. But at the time, I didn't really want one.
At that time, as today, cameras were walking along a progression of sharper images, more ways to adjust this and that. Today, in the digital world, it seems to be pixels. Cameras are putting more and more pixels into the digital field for better sharpness of image. And back in 70, 71, do you remember some of the things that the newer cameras were able to do that was a big deal that might have impressed you at the time?
A little bit, even though I might not remember what year exactly, but just before I was working in that camera store, light meters for the first time started being introduced into the interior of the camera and making readings from what was coming through the lens. So through the lens TTL type light metering system. Prior to that, it was just a photo sensor located on the front of the camera, and it was affected, at least at first, in the early versions, by any bright thing that was out in front of the camera. So this whole globe that you had, or half hemisphere out in front of you, would affect the light meter reading.
Wow.
So once the light meter moved inside, it was much more accurate.
So it was actually looking at the beam of light coming through the lens then?
Right.
Wow.
And there were different ways to do that. One of the new ways was it actually measured the amount of light reflected off of the film, the light that never made it to the exposure of the film, but was reflected off that shiny surface.
Wow.
So there were a lot of changes in kind of a short period of time. And the light meters, instead of being handheld, instead of being on the front of the camera, were inside and really doing a much better job of metering the light.
Okay.
Another thing that I think was just starting about then was a motor drive where you didn't have to move a lever in order to advance the film.
Okay.
Zoom lenses either didn't exist or hardly existed and weren't thought to be very good at that time.
Okay.
If you had a 2x zoom lens, that's about the best lens you could hope for. It didn't have much of a zoom range, but if you got any bigger than that, because we didn't have good computer modeling, or maybe no computer modeling at all for this application, you had fuzzy images at maybe the ends of the zoom range. So it took a long time before we got really good zoom lenses. And now you don't really think twice about buying a zoom lens with a 5x zoom range, and the quality is good pretty much from one end to the other.
Right.
Not perfect, but pretty darn good.
Pretty good. And we don't think about it exactly, as you say.
So back at that time, 50 years ago, zoom lenses were kind of a no-no if you were serious about photography. They just weren't very good.
Okay. So the Nikkor mat was your camera that you were using. Now, you're eventually going to bust loose from back east, or the Midwest, I guess it would be called. There's a river trip and there's Kitt Peak. How did that all kind of line up?
Well, one other thing that ought to be introduced here is that in the summer of 71, I took a break from working at that warehouse, and I and another old college friend, Bob Horton, decided to come out west and explore around. So neither one of us had a car at the time, but we bought together a 1968 International Scout four-wheel drive. And it was in fairly good shape, but I think it already had close to 100,000 miles on it, maybe not quite that much.
I was only 3 years old, and it had really been worked a lot.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, I may be exaggerating here, but let's say 60 to 100,000 miles.
Okay.
In pretty good shape. And we bought it for, I think, $1,600 used.
Huh.
And then went on this trip, and I think we did 12,000 miles that summer, 3 miles, three months. And we started out, I think, in May and drove down to Big Bend National Park in Texas and just worked our way north as the summer progressed. And I certainly don't remember every place we went, although I do have a logbook from that trip. But we went to Big Bend and Carlsbad Caverns and White Sands, to Tucson, to the South Rim, probably stopped at some other national parks along the way, to the North Rim, to Tora Weep and Canyonlands and Arches, and on up through Utah and Idaho and up into Canada.
Wow.
And I think we did.
How did you stay in film?
I think I must have bought a lot. I don't know. But you know, in those days, you didn't take pictures at the rate that you take them today, where they are essentially costless today. So, you know, I just went flying yesterday, and in a matter of a little over an hour, I took 800 digital photographs.
Wow.
Now, that to me seems ridiculous, but on the other hand, it's very expensive, and I'm really trying to document the lake, and I might as well just shoot and shoot and shoot as fast as I can go. But when I used to take aerial photographs using a film camera, I would have a roll of 36 and they would be gone in 5 minutes, and then I'd have to change film. And I've got the window open, so there's dust blowing around, and quite often those images were scratched because I was changing film in a pretty bad environment. So, you know, on a flight of an hour back 30 years ago, I might take, let's say, as many as 150 photographs. That might be an exaggeration. But on that trip, that 3-month trip, I don't remember having a problem with having film, and of course I could buy more along the way too. Mm-hmm.
So. Well, were you, I mean, just, you're exactly right. This touches upon a fascinating discussion of point and shoot, just push the button now today digitally, and if you don't like it, you delete it. If you do like it, you save it on a computer and you go out and shoot some more. The unlimited number of pictures, as fast as you can push your finger, you can collect photographs. Like video, you can pull individual images off of a video now. But in 1971, it was costly. Every picture counted.
Yeah.
So for a roll of 36 images on this trip, would you shoot 36 pictures maybe in a week or in a day?
Well, it depends, you know, what the situation was. And if I saw something terrific, I could go through 36 photographs in 2 minutes.
Okay.
36 in a week, that's not nearly enough. But
okay.
You know, I'd go through a few rolls
okay.
in a week or two. At that rate, I don't really remember, but I do know that if I would go on a Grand Canyon backpack, I would normally take about 15 rolls, so that's about 500 shots for a week.
Yeah, okay.
And then with the 4x5 camera that eventually I started using. When I first started using that camera, the newer system of carrying and containing 4x5 sheets had not come out yet. So I'd have to carry them in holders, which were bulky and very heavy. I could attempt to change film while I was on a backpacking trip, but that also meant that I would have to carry a very heavy black bag, changing bag, which I didn't want to do. So I didn't do that very often, but I would occasionally need to change film on a backpack when I was still using those old holders and try to do it underneath my poncho at night, underneath my... You don't realize how bright the sky is at night until you're trying to change film. Underneath my sleeping bag, and usually those images would end up with scratches on them because it's just on a backpacking trip, you know, your hands have sand on them all of the time.
The dust is, and the grit is just everywhere. It's on your sleeping bag. It's everywhere.
Yep. And your ears and your between your toes.
Let's back up a little bit. When did you first get introduced to 4x5s, and then when did you get excited about them?
Well, I don't think I had any connection with 4x5 when I was living in Missouri. But when I moved out here and started looking at publications and realized that an awful lot of the photographs in those publications were made with a 4x5, that's when I got interested. And specifically, there was a book by Edward Abbey, photographed by Philip Hyde, Hyde, and called Slick Rock. And it was largely about the area where we're sitting here. It, was Glen Canyon, Vermilion Cliffs, Canyonlands. And Philip used a 4x5.
Okay.
And I think I was knocked out by his photographs, and I wanted to know more about that camera that he used. So there's probably more to it than that, but that's what comes to mind.
Okay. And help me for just a minute understand the difference between a Nikon 35 millimeter camera and a 4x5. For somebody that doesn't know about photography, why would you be interested in one over the other?
Well, the simple explanation is just that the quality is much higher. So Nikon has a good camera, the film is very good, the lenses are good, but you can use this more or less the same kind of film in a 4x5 camera and record it on a much larger piece of film, so there's a whole lot more information on the 4x5. 35 millimeter, the original, is 1 inch by 1.5 inches. 4x5, it's 20 square inches, yeah. The disadvantage is that the camera is much larger. It's much more subject to being blown around by the wind. The film is not as well protected. The film itself is bulky and has to be loaded up one sheet at a time. It has to be unloaded one sheet at a time. It's much more expensive, and maybe most importantly, it's very slow. You just don't flick your thumb and advance to the next frame. It's a very slow process, and you pretty much have to use a tripod. With 35 millimeter, much of the time you don't.
Okay. And I'm it's fascinating because I'm thinking about today, as we're digital and we're going for pixels, we're still looking to enhance that quality of the photo, which you were doing when you shifted from 35 millimeter to 4x5. To enhance the quality of the photo. So it's some things, you know, that concept is still with us.
It's still here, but it's to some degree kind of come to an end now, because printing has gotten much more better these days. Images that might have been recorded quite well on film didn't print that well. They were okay, and we got used to looking at pictures of that quality and just accepted that. But printing is much better now. The lens designs are much better, and it's gotten so that we don't really need for publication any better quality. It's great,
Wow.
The way it is.
Okay.
Now, if you're going to make a mural that's 12 feet across, you still want the very highest quality possible. But for magazines and books, we don't need any more pixels.
Okay.
So that may have run its course to some degree.
Okay. Yeah. When did you get your first 4x5?
That happened, I think, in 1977.
Oh, quite a ways away. Okay, so we're going to back up then, because we've kind of jumped ahead into the 4x5 land. And we've been visiting now for almost an hour, and I want to know more about Kitt Peak and your time there, and more about your first river trip with Martin Litton in 1971. So maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview series, and next time we'll pick up those two subjects.
Okay.
So if that's the plan, looking back at what we've just talked about, your time caving, your camera work underground, your slow interest, and then eventually this 1971 road trip, what else do you want to add to this to finish this section off? Have we talked enough about this 1971 road trip?
It was a great trip, but Bob and I hated one another by the time it was over.
Okay.
We eventually recovered, but that's what happens.
Okay, yeah.
I'm not sure I'd be a good person to spend time going to Mars with.
Okay. But it sounds like that trip, well, you had already seen a lot of the West as it is.
Well, briefly, but that trip introduced me to a lot of places that I wanted to see.
More,
yeah. In the case of Grand Canyon, I wanted to see more of it. I had never been to Torrawhip, for instance. At that time, by the way, at Torrawhip, Bob and I drove out there after we had been on a river trip.
And so the river trip happened before this road trip.
Well, I just realized I had forgotten that my first trip was in 1970. Bill Shanning's was in 69, but in 71, as part of Bob and the trip that Bob and I did, we joined Martin's trip at Phantom Ranch.
Okay.
So it was my second trip with him, and that trip was strange because it was a huge group. It was right at the transition for Martin Litton to go from private to commercial. And Ernst Haas, the photographer, was on that trip taking pictures of Grand Canyon for the upcoming Time Life book, Grand Canyon in the Wilderness series. And he had an assistant with him whose name I don't recall, but Martin tried to isolate Ernst from the rest of the group so that Ernst could take his pictures without us being in the way or somehow interfering. So I never got to talk to him. And I didn't feel terribly bad about that, but it just seems strange looking back on it today that, gee, it would have been nice to have spent 5 minutes with him, but on that entire river trip from Phantom down, I never spoke with him.
Wow.
So that was my second river trip that I've been forgetting here, and it was in as part of that long 3 month trip in 71.
In 71. So yeah. Your first river trip was in 1970.
Right.
Okay. So let's pick that up next time, that 1970 first river trip. And that'll put that in there. And then so in 71 you're still working tires for Goodyear.
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, this will then conclude part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Gary Ladd. Today is Friday, March 4th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin. Gary, thank you so very much.
You're welcome. Once again, it went very fast, but I can't believe you're spending so much time on this material that we're covering now.
Well, thank you.